And now, meet the press. Today's guest, Director of the Nation's Peace Corps, Sergeant Shriver. Our panel consists of Lawrence E. Spivak, producer and permanent panel member of Meet the Press, Edwin Dale of the New York Times, Herbert Rowan of Newsweek, and Robert Gorowski of NBC News. Ned Brooks is our moderator.
Our guest today on Meet the Press is the man President Johnson selected to head the anti-poverty campaign, Mr. Sergeant Shriver, Director of the Peace Corps. Mr. Shriver testified this week before the House Committee hearing on anti-poverty program, which the President sent to Congress on Monday. We'll start the questions now with Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Mr. Shriver, before we begin, I know you'll understand that if we put challenging questions to you about the anti-poverty program, it's not because we're for poverty or necessarily against your program. I'd like to start off by asking you what you mean by poverty. I have seen so many definitions. The President says that anybody, any family of four who has less than $3,000 a year is in the poverty group. Someone else has used a figure of $2,500 a year for a family of four. That makes a great deal of difference. You either have 20 million poverty-stricken people or 35 million poverty-stricken. Now, what does poverty mean? Does it mean someone without food and without shelter and without clothes? Or does it also mean someone who doesn't have a television set, who doesn't own his own home and doesn't have a car and doesn't have a refrigerator? What's your definition of poverty outside of a statistical definition?
Well, the one that I think is the most helpful, Mr. Spivak, is the one that indicates that the median income of 9,300,000 families in America today is $1,800 a year, the median income. That means that those families are having to subsist, many of them, on something like $80 to $100 a month for four people. Now, no matter how you define it, to me that's poverty. They're getting too little food, inadequate education, they're living in substandard housing, but most of all, they have no chance of getting out of the condition they're in and joining the rest of American society. It's the hopelessness, the subjection to this poverty on almost a permanent basis. Another interesting statistic is the fact that something like 40% of the people who are rejected from military service today come from families where the head of the family never got out of grade school. So you can see that this is a continuous process. Generation after generation, these people are stuck in poverty. That's the kind of poverty we're aiming at with the President's war against poverty.
Well, now, is money the consideration? Is it the lack of $3,000 a year for a family of four that determines this thing?
No, it's not. And I'd like to get rid of that $3,000 a year figure if I could, because that's only an economist's standard or a statistical device for locating people, you might say. We're not shooting for a person with an income, let's say, of $2,999.99. What we're looking for is the person, let's say with the average person with the income of $1,800 a year, who's mired in poverty, who can't get out no matter how energetic or how ambitious they might be. They don't have the wherewithal to get out, either in terms of education or health facilities or housing or in any other way.
Well, now, why haven't they education? We have compulsory education, I believe, in almost every state of the Union. A boy has to, a girl has to go to a school up until the age of 14. Why don't they know the basics of reading, writing, and arithmetic?
Well, I think if you'd ever been, and maybe you have been, in rural schools, and you've seen the one-room schoolhouse, you see the quality of the education, the kind of books, the demands that are put on the teacher, the fact that most of the families don't understand the value of education themselves, the parents don't understand it. I can remember very well when I was president of the Board of Education in Chicago that there were certain people in the city who actually resisted education. They didn't want it for their children. They were opposed to education. That's the kind of family background that many of the children came from. So it's to families like that and to their children that we're trying to reach with this program.
Well, now, Mr. Shriver, how are you going to cure this situation? You're not going to have any control over those educational facilities. All you're going to be able to do is take those who come out of it and do something with them. But you're going to have a new group coming through them all the time. The fault seems to be in the educational system, doesn't it?
But that's not quite accurate that we won't be able to do anything about it, because we're working very closely with the Commissioner of Education, an excellent one, incidentally, Frank Keppel. And under our program, especially in Title II, the Community Action Program, we intend to concentrate a great deal of money in the improvement of education at the local level. through the local public school systems and under the guidance and direction of the Commissioner of Education.
Now, why, Mr. Shriver, are people poor in this country? There's a Gallup poll that came out today, and most of the American people, a majority of the American people, believe that it's due to lack of effort. And about 46% think it's due to circumstances. Now, in your investigations, why do you find people remain poor? Why are they poor?
Well, I must say I disagree with the majority, as reported in that poll, because I don't think it's just lack of effort. First of all, in many cases, it's lack of adequate medical assistance when they're young, even lack of proper prenatal care in some cases. Second, it's improper education or inadequate education right from the beginning of their lives. Third, it's that they come from a family, in many cases, that has a very poor cultural background and doesn't encourage the children to go on to school. Fourth, it's lack of economics, lack of money. Some cases, there are many cases, tragically too many cases, of children who don't go on, even through high school or through college, because they can't afford to go. Now, all of those things end up by creating poverty.
We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Dale.
Mr. Shriver, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the program itself. In the first place, I assume you would readily concede that it is not, at this stage at least, meant to attack all of the poor.
No. We agree and said right from the beginning, Mr. Dale, that this program was only part of the administration's program to help the poor. It's only one part of it. And then there is, after all, the whole free enterprise system here in the United States that is creating jobs and trying to eliminate poverty.
Well, let's take one very large category of the poor, certainly by any statistical definition and I'm sure by any practical definition, namely the elderly. I believe they're almost one-third of the 30 million people that qualify as being poor. Wouldn't it have been at least of some benefit to them to raise Social Security benefits, for example?
Well, perhaps it might have been. But we're not interested in giving additional handouts. What we're trying to do is to give a leg up, you might say, an opportunity to get out of poverty that a person can utilize themselves. For example, take the older farmer, the man over 45, 50, 55, let's say. And he's a farmer, been a farmer all of his life, and he's a marginal farmer. Now, you can give him more money. But we think it's better to give him a loan and couple that perhaps with a grant, which will enable him to increase his economic status, his income per annum, and thereby become self-sufficient rather than just give him a handout.
True, but Social Security isn't just a handout. It's something that people have earned, and the cost of living has gone up over the years. And I think that many of us believe that the present level of benefits is not adequate to keep an elderly family out of any reasonable definition of poverty. Do you suppose the administration one day will approve an increase in the benefits to the older people?
Well, I couldn't predict whether it will or won't, but I will say this. In our own program, we're studying dozens of ideas, of which this is perhaps a very good one, that might be suggested in future years in order to help in additional ways to alleviate poverty. You yourself pointed out that we're not trying to do everything in one bill in one year.
One more group is the very large number of poor people, including children, who are in families headed by a woman. There again, I don't myself detect anything in the program to lift them off the floor, at least immediately. There's no increase in benefits for them, if I'm correct.
Again, we're not interested so much in giving extra benefits as we are giving them extra opportunities, and we do something for them. For example, under the Community Action Program, it's possible for the children of an employed mother like that, one you just mentioned, to go to a preschool training center, let's say from the age of 3 right up till 6. Now, this is a tremendous benefit to them. It's not a handout, but it's an opportunity to arrive in the first grade prepared for education so that that child will not be either a retarded child, educationally speaking, or a child who thereafter will not be able to go through school properly. That's a big benefit. It's not money, but it's an assistance.
Mr. Rowan.
Mr. Shriver, I'd like to talk a little more about those community action programs. You've stressed that these programs will be derived from local initiative primarily. Now, what happens in some of our communities, and frankly I'm thinking of the South where a lot of poverty as a result of discrimination, where the local communities may not bring forth the initiative to start a community action program. What do you do then?
Well, we would hope to have persons operating out of the Office of Economic Opportunity, that's the technical name for our proposed new office, operating out of that office and representing that office, who would go to those communities and assist them upon request to develop local programs to alleviate poverty.
You're going to stir up business? Is that the general idea?
Well, I don't think, frankly, that there will be much necessity to stir up business because we already know of many communities that are ready to move as soon as this legislation is passed. But for the cases that you were talking about, we could go out and help them.
You won't hesitate to try to inspire some action in some of the worst areas of the country?
No, we would be glad to help wherever we can, but we're not in any sense going out to stir up business. There's plenty of business without stirring it up.
Will the Poverty Office make any loans to racially segregated facilities anywhere in the country?
Our policy will be to follow the administration's policy on that, the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration. As a matter of fact, the policy is pretty well contained in the Civil Rights Bill, which is that no one shall be denied or discriminated against in a federally assisted program, and that's the way we will manage ours.
Mr. Gorulski.
Mr. Shriver, a minute ago, in answer to Mr. Dale's question, you said that you were against handouts, and indeed the program is against handouts, and yet one of the features of the program are grants of up to $1,500 for farm families to get started again. They are not to be repaid back to the government. What would a family do on the farm with $1,500 to raise themselves from the depths of poverty?
Well, you probably know we gave a lot of examples of farm families where a grant of $1,500, when coupled with some loans, could actually bring a family out of the poverty classification. For example, they can get seeds and fertilizers. They could get cattle, beef cattle, milk cattle. And one of the examples that Secretary Freeman gave was the fact that it's better, actually, to provide the cattle for a farmer than to buy his family milk every day when they've left the farm and gone to the city and gone on relief. The state of Illinois, for example, for a family of four, provides $250 a month in public assistance. In 6 months, $250 a month eats up the whole $1,500 capital grant which we proposed for agriculture. So it's much cheaper for the taxpayer in the long run to give this assistance in the form of a grant blended with a loan to keep a person economically viable on the farm than to let that person fail on the farm and go to the city and add to the number of unemployed in the city.
Well, obviously, much of the program depends upon local initiative. Now, where are the local communities and the states going to get the number of trained people to administer this kind of a program?
Well, I was very much encouraged about the local initiative when I noticed that the United States Chamber of Commerce has developed a whole community development program. They've got a great big book. It's about this thick. It tells the communities exactly how to organize local community development programs. Now, this is based on local people doing this, not bringing in outside specialists, but the local people doing it. I think that's the right way to do it. When those programs are developed locally, they can apply to us for a federal assistance. But remember always that our assistance, even in the first year, will only be 90% of the cost. The local community has to come up with 10%.
You acknowledged a couple of minutes ago that it would be very difficult to eliminate poverty completely. Isn't one of the reasons that the poor people just don't have a lobby of their own?
Well, I don't think it's quite that. I think that even if they had a lobby with the inadequate medical assistance and the inadequate education and housing and so on that has existed in many of these places for a large number of years, that even with a lobby, they wouldn't be able to come out on their own. Now, I think that this is a war we can win. I'm not a no-win man in this war. I think we can win it. I think that there's no question about the American economy having reached a point in productivity where we can win it. There's no question about the fact that the people are mobile enough to get around to places where there are jobs. There's new methods of teaching people so that we don't any longer have to be just tied down to traditional concepts. This is a war which can be won. I think that's one of the most exciting things about it.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Shriver, one of the more costly parts of your program is the enlistment of 100,000 young males between the age of 16 and 21 for camps. What assurance do you have that you're going to be able to get 100,000?
Well, we don't have any assurance. In the first year, of course, we're only planning on a maximum of 40,000. But you have to remember that right today there is 1,250,000 men who have, under the age of 22, have been rejected for military service, most of them on lack of mental qualifications. Now, that's a large group, 1,250,000, from which to select just 40,000. In addition to them, there's probably an additional million young men between 16 and 21 who have never even been tested for the military service yet, from whom these camps could draw. So there's a potential for the camps of almost 2 million males in the United States between 16 and 21.
If you were unable to get them, would you consider conscripting them?
Oh, no. No, this is voluntary. There's no conscription in this at all. And if they didn't show up, if they didn't volunteer, if the program wasn't successful, that part of it would just be reduced in the amount of money spent on it.
You've set out to cure poverty by helping the young, by helping to educate them, by helping teach them something about getting jobs and all the rest. How are you going to handle the lazy and the shiftless, those who don't want to work, or those who want jobs that they're incapable of filling? What are you going to do about them?
Well, I think that all of us could probably agree that in any society there will be some people at any one time who can't be helped by any program or any combination of programs, private programs or public programs. But in my judgment, that is a small percentage of the total number of people that we're aiming at. I'd hate to ever reach the conclusion that 9.3 million American families were all composed of people who were shiftless and who did not want to work. My belief, Mr. Spivak, is that the vast majority of them do want to escape from poverty. And the truth of the matter is that since 1947, people have been escaping from poverty at a fairly rapid rate. All we're trying to do is to accelerate that rate so that within the next few years, within the foreseeable future, grinding poverty can cease to exist in this country.
Mr. Shriver, as you must know, that there are people, and not all Republicans, who believe that this is just another political gimmick and that there's going to be a great deal to talk about it up to election time, but that we're not going to see many results. Now, how long do you think it's going to take you to show some tangible results?
Well, let me right off the bat deny that it's a political gimmick. I wouldn't have anything to do with it, Mr. Spivak, if that's all it was. We have tried to create a program which would meet the test of criticism and represent the consensus of intelligent thinking in this country. And I've been very much gratified by the number of leading businessmen, for example, as well as labor leaders who have been attracted by this program. You'll notice that so far in the Congress, it has not been attacked once on its substantive merits. There hasn't been one criticism from the Republican or the Democratic side about the substance of the program.
Mr. Dale.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about the education side of this. If, as you yourself suggested, the problem often begins even before the first grade, and certainly in the elementary grades where children wind up in junior high, scarcely able to read often, I still am not clear as to how the program attacks that problem.
Well, under the community action device, or the community, a plan has to be created. Any one of those plans, in my judgment, should include a large component of educational assistance. And that educational assistance would be given through the local public school system under the guidance and direction of the Commissioner of Education. Now, it would include such things as this. More teachers of English, let's say. More teachers of remedial reading. Remedial reading clinics and laboratories. More guidance counselors for students. Preschool clinics for children before they've even come to school in the age group from 3 to 6. Lots of programs of that type, including the Lighted Schoolhouse, so-called, the program after school, not only for children but for adults.
Without meaning to be captious, is this federal aid to education by the back door?
No, I don't think so at all. What this is, and I think it's always a good idea to remember, this is a program focused on poor people.
It's poor districts, too? Poor districts of the city?
Where the poor people are concentrated, yes. It's not the district we're focusing on, it's the people we're focusing on. And that's true of every aspect of this. It's not an agricultural program or a small business administration program or a labor program or an education. It's a poor people's program. We're trying to hit a target, and that target is poor people.
Mr. Rowland.
Mr. Shriver, many sociologists and educators are convinced that any poverty program that doesn't come to grips with the birth control problem is doomed to failure. Is there a place in your program for handling this problem?
Well, I've noticed that as education improves among people, the size of the family tends to go down. You probably notice the same thing. The statistics show that. And I believe that as we improve education and knowledge among our people, that all kinds of information, including information about proper family planning, will become available to people. Now, we're not going to be running that from Washington. I've emphasized here and in testimony before Congress that this is a program that depends upon local initiative and local ideas and local solutions.
But if the local group incorporated a birth control clinic as part of the community action program, that would be all right.
And if that was acceptable to the local groups, yes.
Yeah.
And I emphasize plural, because all these plans must be comprehensive plans representing the consensus in the community. It can't be just one group that presents a plan.
Yeah. Now, Mr. Shriver, you said to Mr. Spivak that you weren't going to be bound by any statistical definition of poverty, but the working numbers that you've used indicate that some 74% of all families headed by domestics are in a poverty status, and about a quarter of all of the laborers. And there are percentages like this for other groups in the economy. Now, you do have special programs for the rural poor, but how about programs for special occupations? Domestics are too old for the Peace Corps, for the Job Corps, most of them, and they won't be qualified for the training. Now, is there anything that will be done for this group of people?
Well, they would be qualified for the training. They could get training under the Community Action Program.
I see. Well, would some of these people benefit more from other programs outside of the scope of your office?
That's true, they could.
Overtime and shorter work week and that kind of thing?
Yes, they certainly would. Everything that the administration is doing about poverty is not contained in this one piece of legislation. Our job is to try to coordinate the various federal efforts and local efforts so that the total effort is focused on the poor people in the community.
Gentlemen, we have about 3 minutes. Mr. Goralski.
Mr. Shriver, when your only job was director of the Peace Corps, you worked a 12-hour day, and obviously the war on poverty is also a full-time job. Can you do both?
Well, so far, it seems to be going along pretty well. And I will say this, the Peace Corps seems to be almost doing better since I've been working on the war against poverty than when I was there full-time.
But planning to stay with the Peace Corps?
Well, I plan to do whatever the president wants me to do. I came down here to do a job, namely to run the Peace Corps. And I've done the best that I can with that job. I got this second job not because I asked for it. It was given to me. And as a matter of fact, I made some suggestions of alternative people who could do it better than I could.
Well, some people have said that you didn't want the job of heading the war on poverty, that you tried dissuading the president from appointing you. Is this true?
That's true, yes. But then, on the other hand, I tried to get President Kennedy to appoint two or three other different people to run the Peace Corps at the beginning. I haven't sought these jobs, but I do believe that if the president asks any American to take on a job and you feel that that you have a chance of doing it well, you ought to try your best, and that's all that I've been doing.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Shriver, this package has so many things in it, and there are strong suggestions out of Congress that Congress may not give it all to you. Will you settle for less than the whole package if you have to?
I think it would be a mistake to take any section out of it, Mr. Spivak, because it's a blended, balanced program. I think if you took, for example, the agricultural section out of it, that it would be a tragedy because a large proportion of all the poor in the United States are in rural towns or on farms, especially in the southern states.
Well, now, have you assurance from President Johnson that he's going to fight all the way for the whole program despite any pressure that he may get?
I certainly have, yes. No question about that.
Mr. Dale.
I grant this is a bit of crystal ball gazing. You say, Mr. Shriver, that you think the war can be won and that grinding poverty can be eliminated. How long do you think it will take?
Well, I think it's very difficult to project exactly how long it's going to take. But I do recall that Albert Einstein wrote a letter to Franklin Roosevelt in the 40s, and he said, Mr. Roosevelt, it's my belief that it is now possible to split the atom and control the efficient process subsequent to it. Roosevelt didn't ask him how long it was going to take or how much money it was going to take. He just knew that it was worthwhile doing it. We all know that this can be done. I believe it's worthwhile doing it.
Mr. Rowan.
Mr. Shriver, will you have any kind of a means test for admission to the Job Corps?
Not a means test, but we will have a selection system, very much like the selection system that we have for the Peace Corps, because...
Well, suppose a boy comes and he comes out of a family with $4,000 income. Will that rule him out?
No, let's say the family might have 10 children, too. So that would not automatically rule him out, simply because they had an income of $4,000.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up. Thank you very much, Mr. Shriver, for being with us.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. In just a moment, we'll tell you how you can get a copy of this week's Meet the Press interview.
This is Dorothy Gordon speaking. Can religion be taken away from people? The Soviet Union is embarking on a campaign to take religion away from the people, with the accent on atheism. Can the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount be buried in a political command? What does religion mean to youth? A panel of young people representing different faiths will discuss the questions of religion, moral, and spiritual values. Check this station for time and day of the Dorothy Gordon Youth Forum.
Here's an important reminder to housewives from the Internal Revenue Service. January 31st, April 30th, July 31st, October 31st. These are the four deadlines for filing your Social Security tax returns, Forms 942 for domestic employees, Wages of $50 or more paid to any domestic employee, including a maid or babysitter, are subject to Social Security withholding. However, only wages paid in cash, check, or money order are taxable. Do not include the value of car tokens, food, clothing, or lodging. You must file a return for each quarter in which wages of $50 or more are paid to your domestic employees. Tax withheld from the employee's wages, plus your contribution, must be sent along with the return. Circular H, Household Social Security Tax Guide, which furnishes more detailed information on this subject, is available upon request from the Internal Revenue Service. Now, more details on Meet the Press. Today's guest was Sergeant Shriver, recently appointed Special Assistant to the President in charge of the Anti-Poverty Program. And the panel consisted of Lawrence E. Spivak, producer and permanent panel member of Meet the Press, Edwin Dale of the New York Times, Herbert Rowan of Newsweek, Robert Gorowski of NBC News. For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamped self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, M-E-R-K-L-E, Merkle Press, 809 Channing Street, Northeast, Washington, D.C. Join the payroll savings plan. Just tell the bond officer where you work to set the money aside from your paycheck. As you probably know, United States savings bonds have always been a good buy. They've helped send a lot of youngsters through college, bought a lot of houses, made retirement carefree for lots of folks, too. They can do the same for you. So why not start a regular monthly savings bond habit? Enroll in the payroll savings plan where you work or buy bonds at your bank. Meet the Press will be heard again next week at this same time. NBC Monitor News, next on the NBC Radio Network.